right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate.
That's right, I'm back.
And it was a battle getting hit today, I'll tell you, it was really a battle. But I'm battle scarred, but wide awake and ready to go. And we have a really great show for you today, all right? At the back end of the show, it's going to be very heavy. We're going to be talking with some folks from basically who were involved with the January 20th demonstrations at the Trump inauguration and some people who are currently on trial. Let's say not some people, like 214 people, something like that, on trial and facing 70 to 80 years in jail. Okay, and it's a whole group of people that are all charged with the same crimes piled on them, one after the other. And before that, we're going to be talking about basically, we're going to be getting into what's going on with the Folsom Prison hunger strike. And that's an extremely important thing for people to know about. And not enough people know about it right now, but they need to. All right. This is an extremely important front on the battle to deal with all the injustice and to actually wake people up to what this society is all about. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be doing this segment. Somebody sent me something. They sent me a link to a video. And I watched this. And I had been thinking a long time about the need for increased resistance in society to all the fascistic hell that people are being faced with these days that's only getting worse on every front. And the fact that, you know, too often it looks like people are sort of checking it out, seeing what's up, seeing what's happened. But there are people who are actually engaging in standing up and resisting all this. And there needs to be a hell of a lot more than that. You know, this is not something that's sort of the way this stuff plays out. You know, look, you have a fascist in the White House. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. You got to understand what that means, and you got to look at what's happening already in the society. And one of the things that's been happening is massive assaults against immigrant people, and particularly against people from the Middle East. And most recently, there was a big bunch of ICE raids and deportations in the area around Detroit and Michigan, where a lot of people were rounded up in the early morning hours and taken off to camps and await their deportation. But there was another side of the story, which was that people also stood up and fought against this. And I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show today two folks to talk about this. My first guest is Iman Jajani Damon, who is an attorney for many of the people who were arrested. And a little bit later, we'll be talking with Steve Konja, who's the brother of one of the people who was arrested and who is also out there. Folks, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And good morning to you. Thank you for hosting us.
Sure, definitely. Iman, let's jump into this. Describe what happened on the morning of June 11th. What exactly happened?
Yes, ICE officers, probably about 20 person, started at 5 a.m. and basically surrounded people's home. It was like a SWAT team, and it almost looked like a Navy SEAL attack on some kind of terrorist. That's exactly what it looked like. And they attacked them at their home. And as a matter of fact, the home may not sound so offensive, but they went to churches where people were actually going with their children and their spouses, going inside the church. And they went, I mean, there's just nothing sacred to them. They went inside the church and arrested people in front of all the parishioners. They went to their businesses on the streets where they were having coffee at coffee houses. So there's just no limit. And basically arrested all these people who have been complying with orders of supervision with the government. These people have been vetted 100,000%. They're not a danger to the security of this nation. And just arrested them and put them on buses and shipped them away from their families to Youngstown, Ohio, where they're about 5 hours away. And they're all been threatened with imminent deportation.
Mm. Now, as I understand it, ICE was also really kind of close-fisted around whether or not they were going to actually even reveal how many people were rounded up overall, right?
Right. In the beginning, they did not want to indicate how many, but now it's in the open because of the lawsuits that have been filed, and they picked up approximately 140 people. However, it is not stopping, and they have promised to pick up every single person with a final order, and that number is 1,400.
Wow. Wow. And that's just in the Detroit area?
Only in the Detroit area. It is my understanding that they also rounded up people from Nashville, Tennessee. I also heard Texas, and I also learned a few in California, and I personally have a client in Las Vegas, Nevada, who was also picked up. This is all just recent. Mm-hmm. So it is nationwide, but the majority of people were here from the Detroit area because there is a very, very large Iraqi community, but specifically there is a very large Christian Chaldean community who resides in the Metro Detroit area. And the majority of people who were picked up were Christians. Of course, they were Muslim people as well. So it's as long as you're Iraqi, but the majority of them are Christians. And I want to emphasize on that to explain to you later why this is the most egregious violation of human rights in history. And if we don't cure it, this is going to go in history as infamy. I promise you that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get into that right after this next question. ICE claimed that all of the people that they seized that day were being deported because they were, as you mentioned earlier, they were insinuating that they were criminals, that they had past convictions. What's the truth here?
Not true whatsoever. And I speak from personal experiences, not from hearsay. I personally have a client that was picked up prior to Sunday. And he was fooled. He was contacted and said, we need you to come in for your normal order supervision. This individual that I represent, who's Christian, has never violated criminal law, ever. As a matter of fact, he doesn't even have a parking ticket. But he does have a final order of deportation, and I'll explain that in a moment. So they told him to come in, and he's been reporting for the last almost 9 years with no incident, no violation. He does exactly what they tell him to do. So he reported to his order of supervision and got arrested, and he got shipped to Youngstown, Ohio, and said, you're on the list to be deported. This guy has zero criminal violations. So it is not true that everyone who was picked up has a criminal history. That is not true. The majority do, just to tell you, you know, to be truthful, the majority do, but not everybody does.
You're listening to The Michael State Show, and we're talking today with immigration attorney Emin Jajani Daman and Steve Kanja, an activist whose brother was targeted by ICE in a roundup of hundreds of Iraqi immigrants on June 11th, just outside of Detroit, Michigan. But people have been living here, too. Many of the people who were rounded up by ICE have been living here for decades.
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, many of them that I personally represent and know of came here as infants. Some came as toddlers, you know, some at 10 years old. Children, they have lived here all their lives. As a matter of fact, they don't speak any other language but English. They don't speak the official language of Iraq, Arabic. You know, some of them do speak Aramaic, which is the ancient language spoken by Jesus Christ, which is, by the way, a language forbidden in Iraq because it is the language of what they call the infidels. So these people are culturally illiterate when it comes to Iraq. They have zero family in Iraq. Their entire family either already escaped or already living in the United States. So as far as they're concerned, they're as American as you and I. And to take these people, uproot them after they've lived here for decades under one administration after another who never deported them, and now because of an illegal deal that this current administration entered into, okay, back up and you're going to your death sentence. Basically, that's where they're being sent. What I equalize it to, they're being sent to the gas chamber. I promise you that. To me, there is no difference what happened to the Jews than what's happening right now to the Christians of Iraq. They're being sent to the gas chamber.
That's an extremely important point, and we'll come back to that in a couple minutes. I want to move on and talk a little bit to Steve for a while. Steve Kanja, tell me, you know, one thing that ICE hadn't counted on was that this roundup would generate so much outrage among the people, among the Chaldean people. You know, your brother was one of the people that was seized by ICE. Tell us what happened to your brother and why.
My brother was picked up Sunday morning around 7:30 a.m. ICE agents knocked on the door and basically told him put his hands behind him. He was handcuffed and taken. They probably allowed his fiancée a couple of minutes to give him his medication. My brother, with our family, came to the United States back in 1977. He was 15 years old only. Unfortunately, when he was young, he got involved with a wrong crowd of people. He was convicted of conspiracy to sell drugs, sentenced to 23 years in prison. He served it. He had a perfect conduct while in jail in federal facilities. help put together a few programs to help other inmates when they come out, they don't go back to the wrong path. Also, I finished his GDE and continued his higher education. He was released 8 years ago and started working for this company called Wild Bulls Tobacco in Detroit, Metro Detroit. Back then, they had 24 locations. Today, they are 76 locations. They had 100-plus employees 8 years ago. Today, the company employs literally 400 people. He completely turned his life around and bought a house. He was engaged in his way to establish a family. All of a sudden, this is all wiped off overnight, and he's been held and trying to be sent back to Iraq. We have zero family members in Iraq. He doesn't speak English. He has no one there, and as Iman indicated, the Christians in Iraq depleted from 1.5 million today into less than 200,000, all living refugees in their own country. The government of Iraq failed miserably to protect its own people. There are so many militant groups in Iraq today. It's just inhumane. I can't believe this. We're sending all these people, just like she said, to the gas chamber. Mm-hmm. Is this what the United States is about?
Well, it's interesting because you had actually made a comment that actually you learned a lot in terms of what the United States is about through this experience. And I wanted to ask you this, because when you were talking about this being a death sentence, you know, it's also important that people have not just rolled over in terms of what I was talking about earlier, that there has been resistance. I think my assistant had said that you actually were out at the demonstrations and trying to stop the buses when they were taking people out.
I didn't participate in that particular demonstration because, you know, I'm in the press also. We're mm-hmm. trying to do everything between interviews and appearing on CNN with you today, with many, many other outlets throughout the country, trying to put a pressure on the administration to reverse the course. But today, I'm one of the organizers of a huge demonstration taking place in downtown Detroit and in front of the federal building. Mm-hmm. We are trying to send a strong message to the administration. This is inhumane. This is against any laws in the international book. Iraq, we just voted last week. The Congress voted and agreed unanimously that a genocide took place against Christians in Iraq. How are we sending more Christians to their death? If the genocide was committed against Christians, we're less than 200,000 as refugees in our own country. What are we doing here?
Mm-hmm. All right, let me go back to Emin. Emin, tell me something. Did you know anything about the demonstrations against the buses? Because that was one of the first things that I saw.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that a little? Because that was very important for people to understand that this happened. And it got spread all over the country through all kinds of social media. And I thought it was very important for people to see that there were people standing in front of the buses, trying to stop the buses who were just taking off with all these people going to what you've described as a sheer hell and worse. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's talk about the demonstrations that happened.
Well, what happened on Sunday when the majority were picked up were men. Their families, mostly children, their wives, their mothers, sisters, etc. They all went to the ICE office in downtown Detroit to try to inquire, what are you doing with our loved ones? They have never violated. And they basically met with deaf ears. It's a gated office. They shut the gates in their face and they would refuse to talk to them. They refused to give them any information. One woman passed out from severe anxiety and stress, and many others were just crying, and they could see their loved ones being led outside the building in handcuffs and being placed on buses. And these buses were all had armored guards in them, and they were screaming for them, you know, help, help. And then the other side of it was just emotional. And the other side of the fence, the families are screaming, please give us information. Let us talk to them. Again, it all fell on deaf ears while these people were being driven to Youngstown. I should mention, by the way, on that same day when they picked them up at 5 a.m. in the morning, They were given no food and water until the next day on Monday, when they finally made it to the prison facility in Youngstown, Ohio, Sunday night. But they were not given any food or water until Monday. And mind you, one of the people who was picked up is a man who was just released from the hospital with a brain tumor and wanted to die at home. He was dragged out of his bed and taken to the facility, and I spoke with one of my clients there in prison who said, this man is going to die any day now. They've just expedited his trauma. They picked up a man who was 80 years old in a cane who could hardly walk. So, you know, like Steve said, where is the humanity? We regard, you know, this nation throughout history, we've always regarded ourselves as the guardian and the beacon of human rights. What happened to human rights? When do we ever take an individual and send them to a war-torn country? Our country historically has always given protection for people whose country is at war. You know, call TPS, temporary protective status. This has been given by Congress throughout the years. When Syria erupted in war, we gave Syrian citizens in the U.S. TPS so they don't become illegal, because we protect them and not send them home. When Yemen broke in a war, El Salvador, Kuwait, when Saddam Hussein invaded it, and I could go on and on and on. Whenever there is war in a country, the U.S. always says, we are not going to send its nationals back. We give them TPS. Well, as you know, since 2003, Iraq has just been dwindling to the abyss. Never a TPS has been granted, but let alone taking people who came here legally, who were here on legal status, and sending them back to die. I mean, how is that justified when our country last year under the Obama administration, when John Kerry declared genocide is actually being committed against the Christians and the minorities on the hands of ISIS in Iraq? So we've already given an almost impossible designation that is rarely given since 1948 when the UN declared genocide. So to be given that designation, that means we've reached a conclusion after a major factual report that indeed these people are being persecuted. They're being killed. So there's law in our nation. There is law that says you cannot refoul or deport someone where they can be killed, tortured, or injured. And that law is also, we were signatory to it in November of 1994, called Convention Against Torture. So if you want to talk about law, it's on the books. And I say the law applies to everybody from top to bottom, mm-hmm. whether you are the executive branch or where you are the little guys who were picked up, the law is the law and it must be followed. We can't haphazardly use law that suits every administration that comes in. And if I could just mention that people have had the deportation since the 80s and 90s, we didn't have a president decide to deport them. You know, we've had Reagan, we've had Clinton, we've had Bush, we've had Obama. None of them said, let's get rid of these people, because they knew Iraq is a troubled country that persecutes its minorities. So why is it all of a sudden now acceptable to this administration to say, send Christians to their death?
Because they are a fascist regime, and we should talk about that more. But right now, Iman, I'm going to have to move on. But I wanted to actually ask you, and just very quickly, you know, you had said that this is one of the worst violations of human rights, and you talked, compared it to the gas chamber. How can people stand up and join this fight? And we have to be really quick on this.
Yes, I will be. Remember in January when the first executive order said we're banning seven countries from coming to our country. And by the way, those citizens didn't have the rights to be here. And the entire country went out and demonstrated and said, this is not who we are. This is not our nation. We don't do this. This is why we came here. This is the melting pot. We accept people. This is wrong. That's what needs to happen. What needs to happen is that we do not send people to die. We don't send people to be persecuted. You know, how is the United States going to take this responsibility of sending people to their death? How are we internationally going to stand up and defend human rights? So us as a nation need to unite and join hands like we did back in January in airports and everywhere and say, no, just because you're the president does not mean you are a dictator. You cannot decide to kill people in the name of the United States of America.
And I would say we should add, no, we will not accept the fascist America. There you go. All right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Iman, Steve, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm sorry I have to move on, but it's really been really important for people to hear what you guys had to say. And is there?
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay. All right. And we'll be in touch. Stay in touch and we'll follow this closely. All right. Take care now.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Iman Jajoni Daman and Steve Kanja, who both people who have been involved in fighting against the deportations of Chaldean people back to Iraq to face certain death, okay? And this is what the Trump regime is doing. And there has been all kinds of resistance against that in the streets in around Detroit, and it's important for people to follow this here. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Speak about revolution, they must speak about a change, because we are human beings and we got to be treated like human beings.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
If you put people under these kind of conditions, they're going to rebel, you know, and that's what Attica teaches you.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
This September marks the anniversary of the historic Attica State Prison Rebellion and Massacre. The story of Attica is one of the most heroic and brutal chapters in U.S. history. After a five-day occupation, 43 people were killed, 150 were shot, and 1,289 tortured. As one of the slogans of that time put it, Attica is all of us.
All right, you were listening to the words of Attica prisoners who took over Attica Prison and decades ago, and they shook the world. And right now, this still remains, you know, as much as the heart that went into prison rebellions and people fighting against injustice and all this. This system is going to continually round people up, and especially oppressed nationalities, people from other countries, you know, black people in this country. It's going to round people up and force them into these hell holes to die, to spend their entire life behind bars. Whatever. This is what America is about. Okay, it's a big part of this. And joining us to talk about right now, there is a strike going on at Folsom Prison. And it's an extremely important thing for people to know about. All right, it's extremely important. It's a hunger strike. And joining us to talk about the strike are Mohammed Sheikh from Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity and Raquel Estrada, whose husband, Anthony Estrada, has been part of the strike. Mohammed, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And Raquel, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. And we'll be, let me start off by asking Mohammed a couple questions quick. Tell us what's happening with the hunger strike now. When did it begin and why?
So the hunger strike started at Folsom Prison on May 25th. And actually, most recently, we have heard that the hunger strike has been suspended. The reason that the hunger strike started was there were prisoners in administrative segregation, which is a form of solitary confinement, and they were going on hunger strike to protest against inhumane conditions. They were demanding basic rights and basic access to needs that would, you know, mitigate against the torturous conditions against solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. And did you say that the strike is actually, in fact, over now?
Yeah, the last that we've heard is that the strike has been suspended.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that the prisoners are still not demanding the same things that they were asking for. People on the outside are still supporting the demands and asking for those basic things to be met.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what the actual demands of the prisoners are.
Yeah, so the prisoners came up with a list of 9 demands, and they ask for things like adequate access to courts and legal assistance, educational programming, allowing televisions which is an important thing, you know, when you're in isolation, in a condition of solitary confinement that has been defined by torture, even by the United Nations. Having access to televisions is very basic and important to mitigate against the torturous effects of solitary confinement. Having access to exercise equipment, one important thing that has been an ongoing struggle has been an end to sleep deprivation. You know, across the state, particularly in Folsom Prison and Pelican Bay, is that the prison guards have been depriving prisoners of sleep through what's called welfare checks or security checks, where every half hour, every hour throughout the day, they will make loud noises. They'll knock on the cells to wake up prisoners. And this is sleep deprivation, which is clearly a form of torture. So demanding an end to sleep deprivation. They were demanding just adequate clothing, having access to a bowl and cup for to eat and drink. You know, so these are very basic things that they're demanding, and just shows you the extent to how harsh and how degrading the conditions are inside of Folsom Prison.
Yeah, it's very heavy. Some of the things I was reading were just you know, stunning. I mean, even as much as that, and I paid a lot of attention to what's happening in prisons. And one of the things, just even to see that people were being forced to eat out of old baggies, you know, plastic baggies and stuff, that, you know, it's just incredible, the kind of the dehumanization that is part and parcel of the entire prison system that was being enforced dramatically, you know. Let's talk with Raquel now. Raquel Estrada, your husband, Anthony Estrada, has been part of the hunger strike. Now, can you tell us why Anthony became part of the strike?
He became part of the strike when he was admitted into the into solitary back in January and just saw the living conditions that they were in, which is way worse than what they are in the SHU currently, in the security housing units currently.
Tell us about those conditions. What do you know about the conditions?
Pretty much what it says right here on the demands. They didn't have adequate clothing, so they're forced to walk around in the boxers. The shoes, they only have shoe exchange. I think it's like once a year. So if your shoes right now, it's pretty much you need to sew them back up or figure out how to use them pretty much. So they don't have any food bowls or cups, so they did have to eat out of Ziploc bags if they're lucky. Otherwise, they use the big trash bags. And this is the food for the canteen, so they unpackage it. And so by the, you know, they're put in bags, so they go stale a lot of the time. The deodorant's taken out of the containers. They put in little bags, baggies. To courts, if they're fighting court cases, they don't have access to legal assistance, so a lot of them don't know exactly what they're facing or how long they'll get if they plead guilty or don't understand their charges correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, education.
Yeah. What about education?
They lack education, and there's only one teacher in Folsom Prison, which they go to mainline, and then they're split between the ranch also and the women's facility. So by the time they get down to solitary, they're only given maybe like one sheet of paper, and it's like, here, circle the bubbles, and that's pretty much their education right there. So they don't have access to GEDs or high school diplomas or anything like that.
Let me remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking about the recent Folsom Prison hunger strike in California. And we're speaking with Raquel Estrada, whose husband is on strike, and Mohammed Sheikh from Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity. Now, one thing I read that you mentioned about in terms of the conditions was there was a certain type of radio. I can't remember what it's called, but a crank radio.
A crank radio.
Yeah. Now, tell us about that, because that seemed to be something that when you're talking about people who are in isolation, people who are in a cell so long, you know, so long themselves, and then, you know, no contact with the outside world to a certain extent, and having to, you know, all the conditions that you were laying out, and then they get one thing, an old-time crank radio, and tell us about that and what happened.
When they first arrive there to solitary, they're given a crank radio by the prison. And 20 days, if you don't have someone to buy a crank radio for you or anyone's willing to provide for you, they automatically take that away because it's only loaned to you for 20 days. So then you're left with nothing, no crank radio, no TV, nothing. So you're just there by yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
With nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you've also spoken about one of the things that, and it was very poetic, there was something that was in the materials I was reading where someone talked about with only misery as company. For a lot of the prisoners, that's the way this thing feels, with only misery as company. And your husband actually you know, talked about the conditions that he's faced. And he also talked about some of the things that, like, you got into this as well. Some of the things in terms of people actually being supposedly the time that they do in Folsom is somehow taking away from or related to what they're supposed to be doing in terms of shoe time, which I was trying to figure out what did that actually mean. You said that there was actually there was a conflict there that was going on between people doing time in Folsom and then the question of them then having to go on and do shoe time or doing shoe time in Folsom. And I'm not sure what that all that means. I was going to ask you about that.
Okay, so the shoe time. Right now where they're supposed to be in Folsom, it's only supposed to be short-term housing. But a lot of them are not being moved to security housing units, you know, like Pelican Bay or Corcoran. They're being held there because they have court cases. They're not being heard yet. And so that's why they're there. They're serving a shoe term in an administrative segregation unit facility, which is only supposed to be short-term housing, not long-term housing.
Mm-hmm.
So they've already been found guilty of a crime. They haven't been heard yet. That's where they're there.
Now,
which is crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, and fascistically, you know, just incredible in terms of the oppression and repression that's being unleashed on people. Tell me this, Raquel, you went to Folsom recently expecting to visit your husband. What happened when you got there?
When I arrived there, they told me that he wasn't there, that they had moved him that morning.
Where did they move him to?
They moved him over to Tracy. So he's about an hour, I think it's about an hour and a half from Folsom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you been able to talk to him?
I have, actually, as I have been. I've been able to visit him every weekend so far.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you if there's anything else you'd like to tell people about this, because I do think your husband has actually, you know, spoken about some very soaring and things in terms of what's going on with people and what's related to this whole, basically this inhuman and fascistic assault on prisoners. And I thought this was really, really important for people to understand the importance of what the prisoners have been doing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, they're trying to unite everyone to come together and try to fight this. We're trying to help everyone raise awareness for solitary and help get them out or improve their living conditions. It's unacceptable what they're doing, to be in solitary 24/7 with nothing in their cells and dehumanizing them. It's horrible.
Mm-hmm. Now, what can people do now? I mean, given the situation now, what's going on now, what can people do now?
They could call Warden Rackley. He's a prison there. He's a warden there at Folsom State Prison. They could call the ombudsman, Sarah Smith. She's the ombudsman there for Folsom State Prison. They could call the governor. They could call everyone on the list that's there online or everyone directly connected to the CDCR and just ask them to help in this situation.
Mm-hmm. All right, Raquel, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I'm going to move back and basically let's get back to Muhammad and hear what you have to say, Muhammad. What can you add anything on to this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, well, the one thing that I just want to say is that, you know, this isn't new. This isn't something that we haven't seen before. This is exactly what the prison regime, CDCR, has done before. They've, you know, attempted to justify this kind of behavior, this kind of treatment against prisoners by labeling these prisoners as, you know, the ones in solitary confinement as the worst of the worst, as, you know, the gang members and leaders. And we've just seen this as a racist attempt to target people who are politically resisting their confinement and the conditions of their confinement. And what we've also seen is that these prisoners, you know, on their hunger strike have actually connected this hunger strike to the one that happened in 2013 and also in 2011 in California prisons, where over 30,000 prisoners went on hunger strike, and it was also led by and organized by people in solitary confinement. In that case, it was in Pelican Bay. And that was a strike that was also demanding very basic things. And this is part of a legacy of, you know, prisoner resistance, prisoner struggle against oppression and repression, as you mentioned. And it's a long, ongoing struggle. And what we see here is that hunger strike that happened in 2013, which resulted in a settlement against CDCR, and a legal settlement, that was actually a pretty big victory against the use of solitary confinement in California. What we're seeing is that here in Folsom Prison, they're trying to wiggle around the gains made in that settlement against solitary confinement by doing the same things, except now they're putting people in administrative segregation and keeping them in there for way longer than what is actually allowed. Because administrative segregation is supposed to be a very short-term thing in the prison system. It's supposed to be just very ad hoc. But what they're doing is actually putting people in administrative segregation for extended periods of time. And so they're actually just replaying the same fight that has happened against the SHU, the security housing units. Mm-hmm. And there's a big precedent. And just as the struggle against solitary confinement in the SHUs that was started by prisoners in Pelican Bay was successful and victorious, this fight is also going to be supported, and we're not going to give up until the prisoners' demands are met.
Okay, now real quick, where can people go to find out more information about the work you're doing?
So people can visit, we're posting regular updates on Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
.wordpress.com.
Okay, great. I want to thank you very much, Mohammed. And Raquel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and stay in touch. If there's new developments, definitely let me know, okay?
Definitely. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Take care now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye now. I'm going to end this segment with reading something that's from one of the prisoners there. It says, "Unfortunately, our voice in here can be drowned out by administration, but those out there can help by making their voice heard in concern with our treatment," the prisoners said. "We urge you to call and email all officials and ask questions on the conditions here and make sure the procedures are met for those hunger striking." Basically, folks, prisoners are calling on you to stand up and resist what's going on in the concentration camps that exist across this country that are filled. I mean, you look at the numbers, they're filled with oppressed people and in ways that have never been dreamed about in any other society, all right? You look at that, it's extremely important for people to step up and pay attention to that and to stand with people when they do fight that. We've been talking with Mohammed Sheikh from Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity and Raquel Estrada, whose husband has been part of the hunger strike at Folsom Prison. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk about what happened in D.C. on the inauguration day of Donald Trump. And we're going to be speaking with Sam Manafi-Leiby, and he's got a whole hell of a lot to tell us, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Architects, and it's from the album Endgame by Rise Against, and it's a really powerful song. And joining us now to talk about what the hell happened in Washington, D.C., and that continues to happen in relation to the, who knows what that monster is sitting in the White House, Sam Manafi-Leiby. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, sure, man. And by the way, I watched your the video you have, and I went at the end of the interview. You're going to tell people how they can actually find that and follow it. So I know you get really excited about this. So we got to get – let's jump up on this, man, because people got to know about this. For those who don't know, can you describe what went on in D.C. on the day of Trump's inauguration, and how did the J-20 defendants become the J-20 defendants?
Sure. So, I mean, I'm here as a member of the D.C. Legal Posse, which is a group that came together after the mass arrest on January 20th. On January 20th, on Trump's inauguration day, there was an organization called Disrupt J20 that pulled together folks who engaged in all forms of direct action, people from across the country and really from across the world, did things like blockading checkpoints onto the mall for folks who would become spectators for Trump. So if you go and see aerial photographs of the mall that day, you'll see that the north half of the mall is notably emptier than the south half, and that's because of the direct action that was undertaken by folks that day. There were parades of resistance, there were festivals, there were fairs, there were speakouts, there were concerts. There was also an anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march. That anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march was met with hundreds of cops in full riot gear who indiscriminately deployed pepper spray and what are called stinger grenades, which are like concussion grenades with rubber cluster munitions in them, and wound up kettling over 230 people. Over 200 of those people are still facing charges. They mass charged all 230 people with felony riot, and subsequently in a superseding indictment at the end of April, added 8 more felony counts, including conspiracy to riot, destruction of property, assault on a police officer. It's been really crazy.
Now tell me this, Sam. Just for people that don't know, when you say they kettled people, what does that mean?
So kettling is a technique that's actually been banned by the European High Court of Human Rights, amongst other things, where basically riot cops surround and compress and don't allow people to escape. Oftentimes, it means that they're creating a line that you can't break through with shields and then deploying so-called less lethal munitions into the kettle to basically try and do mass arrests and mass brutal brutality.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this case, what you're talking about they did then is that they actually penned people up in this kettle maneuver and then basically went in, did their beating, their spraying, all this other kind of stuff. But they also just, for all these people, some of whom may have just been marching with the people who got stopped, some of whom who actually could have been crossing the street. And I understand there were actually a lot of journalists, there were other people that kind of got caught in the middle of all this. And people were just rounded up, put there, and held for many hours. And as you said, under attack. In a certain sense, with all the pepper spray, all the gas, all this other stuff, the clubbings, these things like that. It's like catching people, anybody who's in, it's like going into a township in South Africa and catching 500 people, putting them into a big hole and just going to hell with them.
Exactly. So there are dozens of videos online of police brutality, both in and outside the kettle from Inauguration Day. You can go to our website, dclegalposse.org, and there are numerous links to videos. And yeah, I mean, the folks who were, the over 230 people who were kettled by the Metropolitan Police Department, which is the police department in D.C., were, subject to all sorts of these so-called less lethal munitions, and then held for for over 9 hours without access to bathrooms, food, or water before being processed. And actually, the MPD didn't have the capacity to deal with 230 arrestees, so they shuttled them all over the city. Most of them didn't have very much to eat, if anything. They didn't provide any options for the vegans in the group, and no one had the opportunity to wash off any of the pepper spray. So everyone kept reactivating the pepper spray all night and all through the next day.
Mm. And so everybody who the cops didn't sum up as like was a reporter or an innocent bystander who managed to convince them that they were not part of the demonstration, all these other people basically sat in. And we're at the mercy of the cops to do whatever they wanted. And they sat in this horrific situation and then were hauled off to jail?
They were, yeah. They were hauled off to jail overnight before being arraigned on felony riot the next day. I mean, they sat there all day. They were also, they were kettled at, a little after 11 a.m. And the cops were continuing to be brutal to people both in and outside the kettle. A little after 1 p.m., MPD started indiscriminately throwing stinger grenades and pepper spraying the crowd outside the kettle. And that lasted for hours. So people were actually terrified. I mean, that they were just, explosions going on around them and mass deploying of pepper spray and screaming. And they saw children getting hit with pepper spray and people being indiscriminately attacked. And folks were terrified. They didn't know what was happening and no one would tell them. And they were just trapped there for hours and hours and hours.
Now, let me ask you this. You've already mentioned this a little bit, but I wanted to dig into it a little bit more. The charges that people were facing, because people, you had these hundreds of people who were marching in a demonstration, and they're not facing individual charges, you would think. Just logic would say each person would be charged with whatever they're doing. But this was a group arrest, and they were faced with group charges without any indication of, you did this, we can pinpoint your face doing this. You did this, we can pinpoint your face doing this. They're just basically group charges, group punishment.
Right. So, I mean, listeners who are curious can actually find the superseding indictment online that was released on April 27th, and they can read through it, and they'll see that, there are a couple of people here and there that are alleged to have committed specific acts, but most people are just being charged en masse. And yeah, I mean, even the five counts of destruction of property are being charged to everyone, as if everyone was responsible for each act. And it's really wild. I mean, the lack of particularized suspicion here has lawyers across the country both baffled and up in arms.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, you know, because this, and people have to understand this, there was this massive arrest, and there was initial charges, and then there were later charges. And just one thing right away, just so we can make clear to people, people are facing how many years in jail?
We've gotten different numbers from different people, but the average is about 75 years if they're convicted on all counts and sentenced to the maximum.
75 years in jail?
For showing up to a protest.
Yeah. Isn't fascism wonderful? Tell me this. You also have, I have been involved in cases in D.C. that had lots of defendants, but I've never seen anything like this. 214 defendants and 230 lawyers. This is actually extremely significant in my mind, and it also opens the door to this Orwellian-quality legal repression. You know, the idea that people are guilty by virtue of being at a demonstration of anything that happened at that time or in the immediate vicinity.
Yeah, I mean, it stretched the capacity of the D.C. Superior Court where the cases are actually being tried to. I mean, they don't know how to handle this many people. You know, it's been almost comical, if it weren't so scary and sad, to see the judge try and deal with dozens of defendants in a single status hearing, and to just, you know, wonder how they're going to have the capacity to bring all these folks to trial. They've also, you know, as you mentioned, they upped the charges afterwards, and you know, this seems a clear-cut case of punitive charging, where they're just trying to get folks to plead out. They don't have the capacity to deal with all of these, to actually grant people's right to trial, right, and respect people's right to due process. And so they're just trying to stack on charges until people buckle under the pressure and the terror of the possibility of spending the rest of their lives in prison and you know, plead to some lesser charge.
Right. And so basically these charges are piled on and applied to every defendant indiscriminately, no matter what they can actually prove of that individual did or did not do.
Exactly. Yeah. And so as you mentioned earlier, of the initial 230 arrests, there were legal observers, there were journalists, there were lawyers, there were medics, and a number of people had their charges dropped. But several medics and several journalists are still facing charges, and they're facing the same charges as everyone else. And their charges are just as legit, just as bogus as everyone else as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that really stands out, it's definitely the case, and you look at this, and it really is an assault, a fascist assault on democratic rights. It doesn't mean just that we're going to, you know, new laws, but it's also using the existing laws to carry out this kind of repression. And one of the things is the trashing of the First Amendment is something that you've spoken to a lot. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean this is a weird case. I guess it's not weird, right? It's totally typical. This is the same sort of situation and experience that millions of people in the United States have faced in their confrontation with the so-called criminal justice system, especially people of color and especially people on the left. Here we have an instance where an assistant U.S. attorney, Jennifer Kirchhoff, who is an Obama appointee, is explicitly trying to overturn a standing case precedent that says riot statutes can't be applied to First Amendment activity, and is blatantly trying to set new precedent that allows all of these standing laws to be applied to protesters and resistors and dissenters and those who are trying to create a better world.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sam Menefee-Leiby from the Dead City Legal Posse, otherwise known as the D.C. Legal Posse. And we're talking about the extreme charges being leveled against Inauguration Day protesters arrested in Washington, D.C. Now, tell me something. There's something else that you brought out in this in terms of, like, for all the people that have been arrested. One of the things that was really interesting in terms of the political, when you're talking about the Nazification that's going on across the entire country, and you're looking at this, and there are things that happen to the people that have been in prison, and anybody who's ever been arrested, especially a political arrest, knows that there's things, you know, you remember, you don't bring names and addresses into the demonstration with you, all this other stuff, because you, in a certain sense, it's possible that if you get arrested, the cops are going to take them and start adding those names that you may have in your pocket, in your wallet, to their, keep an eye on list. But in this case, they actually took people's cell phones and examined them for content. Is that right?
They did, yeah. So everyone who had a cell phone at the time, it was confiscated and it was held as evidence. No one has gotten their cell phones back. Most of the cell phones were encrypted, and there was reporting done by Mashable, I believe, that said that an Israeli security company, Cellebrite, has been hired to actually hack into the encrypted cell phones. They also raided another activist's house on April 3rd and took every piece of electronics in the house that belonged to him and anyone else in the house. including speakers that he had attached to his computer. They're clearly trying to data mine as much as they can. And there have been also multiple subpoenas that people have had for online social media accounts and sort of online profiles. They really are trying to go in and track down every piece of public and private information they possibly can about people and, weave it together into some sort of argument that would allow them to apply these laws and send people to prison for life for protesting.
Now, the other thing here is you also talked about doxing happening to some people. Let's talk about that. Tell people what it is and what it means that it's happening.
Yeah, so doxing, sometimes spelled D-O-X-X-I-N-G, sometimes spelled as just one X, is a process where folks have personal and sensitive information put out online, oftentimes for the purpose of them being bombarded by harassment or sometimes even the threats of physical violence. There's been a series of doxing incidents in this case. The first major one was actually a PDF with the charging documents for all 230 arrestees with their full names and addresses was posted online on, I believe, Chuck Johnson's website. And metadata later suggested that PDF actually came from an officer of the MPD. So, we've seen both doxing by online trolls, hacking into people's accounts, but also, doxing by members of the police.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. We're getting towards a point where we have to wrap up, and I do want to keep in touch with you throughout this the rest of the course of this, so we'll have you back again to report on how things as they develop. But right now, what would you say is imperative for people to understand and for people to do?
So that's a great question. I think that it's really important right now that folks start paying attention to this case. It's been just criminally undercovered. There's been some great reporting from Patrick Strickland at Al Jazeera. There was a great piece in The Baffler written by Maximilian Alvarez. You can go to our website at dclegalposse.org. And there's a website, defendj20resistance.org, that has all the news clips and updating, has been updated sort of consistently for folks to get a good handle on what's going on. As you mentioned earlier, I also did a live video on Tuesday with CrimeThink that sort of gives an overview of the case to date that folks should be able to find online through CrimeThink's Facebook page, through their website, through the DC Legal Posse Facebook page, through our website, or just by Googling my name, Sam Menefee-Leiby. So people got to start paying attention. We've raised tens of thousands of dollars so far, but for over 200 defendants, that's just a drop in the bucket. We got to raise more money. So you can donate at dclegalposse.org, or there are places to donate to regional groups of defendants on defendj20resistance.org. We're also going to be pursuing the DC Council after the Office of Police Complaints issued a report condemning police brutality on Inauguration Day and suggesting an independent investigation. We testified to the DC Council, and the DC Council has in fact allotted $150,000 for an independent investigation into the Metropolitan Police Department's actions on Inauguration Day. And so people should pay attention to that, should call the DC Council and ask about that, pressure them to start the investigation immediately. They can also get more information about that on our website.
Okay, and I lied. I have one more question for you. One more thing in terms of, and I just want this to get out to people because we've talked about a whole lot, and I want people to, again, one, you said CrimeThink. You should tell people tell them how to spell it, and because I do think your video is extremely important. So right now, before I go any further, tell them how to spell it so they can get to that.
CrimeThink is C R I M E T H I N C, and you can find them on Facebook or at crimethink.com.
And I really recommend people do that because it'll give you a hell of an understanding of what's going on, a beginning understanding of it. Now, I want you to step back for a minute, Sam, and just look at this in relation to when the day before January 20th, what is it that made you and made others that you work with feel compelled to be out in the streets like that? And that continues to make you feel that you have to, beyond the camaraderie and the need to step in and support each other, but what continues to make you feel that this is the most important thing that people can be doing in terms of, what you guys did in terms of the demonstrating around at the inauguration and the seating of the fascist ruler, which is sort of, and that's not a joke. It's actually a reality. And let's talk about that. What is it that you think is so important about that? And what can you say to people in terms of what they need to do?
I think that you've seen mobilization all across the country, millions and millions of people, many of whom have never showed up before, protesting because things are horrifying right now. We have a looming climate catastrophe. We have a situation where eight men control as much wealth as the bottom half of the entire world population. We have a situation, we have a carceral state that where that houses and continues to, you know, engage in repression of millions of people, especially people of color all across the country. You have money that's, you know, totally wrecked the political process.
We have 30
totally
seconds.
Unresponsive political parties. I mean, you have an entire situation that is just, we're in crisis. And I think that, the appropriate response to crisis is for people to stand up and mobilize and take action and demand that they have some control over their lives.
All right. I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And Sam, we'll have you back again soon. All right.
Great. Thanks so much.
Take care, man. Okay. And remember, folks, you can go to my Facebook page for links to all the websites mentioned on this program. All right, this brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank my guests, Emin Jajani Damin and Steve Kanja on the ICE raids in Detroit, Raquel Estrada and Mohammed Sheikh talking about the Folsom Prison hunger strike, and Sam Menefee-Leiby from the Dead City Legal Posse on the J20 defendants and the outrageous jail terms they are all facing for standing up and demonstrating against Trump during his inauguration. And I want to thank all the people that work on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Kiana Williams. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs. It's Attica Blues from Archie Shepp. Talk to you again next week. And I want